And I got a very interesting conversation with the medical examiners before I was writing fiction and talking to, you know, docs that did autopsies all the time. And I was saying to him, how could you be in such a good mood? You're like, you see these horrible, horrible things and you got to take them apart, you know? And he looked at me and he says, look, when I get them, their suffering's over.
You're listening to Scars We Share. I'm your host, Kayleen. The last guest I had and the next few are all authors I was put into contact with. They have all shown up with beautiful vulnerability, and I hope you enjoy them. This week, I had the absolute pleasure of talking with Terry Shepherd. He is energetic and so fun to talk to. He talks about the characters he creates, depression, suicide, and more. Here's Terry.
Kayleen, what a treat to be with you. I'm Terry Shepherd, and I write books. I tell stories. That's what I do for a living. It's my full-time job, and it has been for about the last 24 months. You can find out about me at terryshepherd.com. That is where all the links are to my other social media presences. I'm on Facebook. I'm on Twitter. I'm on Instagram. And any other place that's cool. I've been fooling around with Clubhouse lately, which is brand nice. New. It's and the storytelling part has been an absolute wonderful journey, a journey of discovery, a journey of new friends, and most of all, a journey of healing.
Yes. Oh, yes. Amen to that. Sorry. I love stories. And I think that there is so, so, so much healing that can come from stories, both like fiction and nonfiction, because typically when you're writing fiction, you put yourself in it. Like, I don't know. I have a degree in theater and my emphasis was in playwriting. And so like, I love writing. I love stories. And there were so many times when I put pieces of myself in my plays to just kind of work through things. And I don't know, there is so much healing in stories. So I think that's wonderful. So how many books have you written?
Wow. Well, in the nonfiction category, I have 6. Wow. And in fiction right now, I have one thriller, which has been out for about a little over a year. The sequel to that thriller will be out next month. The third part of the trilogy is about 2/3 done. And along the way, I had the John Lennon experience. You remember that saying, life is what happens when you make other plans?
Yes.
I thought that I was getting into fiction to write about fantastic women detectives and diverse casts of people so that my readers would look at those books and say, hey, maybe I could be that hero too.
Yeah.
But then I brought my grandson home from school one day. At the time he was 8, and he said, Grandpa, do you have a job? And I said, yeah, I'm an author. I write books. And he says, why don't you write a book about me? And so that's how the Waterford Detective series happened. And then along came the pandemic and our grandkids, now 10 and 5, were asking questions about this scary thing that was going on. And an interesting dimension of our 5-year-old is that she was born with Down syndrome. So she's working with a very unique toolbox. So I needed something that could resonate with every age group. So I thought about the books that I loved most when I was a kid. And despite the somewhat political incorrectness of some of his work, my favorite stuff was by Dr. Seuss. Yes. So what I did was I got together with my son-in-law, who is a graphic artist and illustrator, and he wrote the picture, drew the pictures. And I wrote the story of how to wash your hands, how to sneeze, how to wear masks, and how vaccines work. And that became Juliet and the Mystery Bug, which I never intended to create. When I did it, I made it for an audience of 2. And now at this very moment, it's being presented to the CDC in DC, the American Medical Association, and we're pitching it to Pfizer and Moderna as tools that they can use as the vaccine becomes available to younger kids. So totally other plans, you know? I had no idea I was going to do this. And it happened.
Oh my gosh, I love that so much. Oh, I love that so much. And like, I seriously love using books as a tool to teach kids. absolutely love it. Like, I have three kind of neurodiverse children, and I have a book that's called Visiting Feelings. And it talks about, like, how does the feeling come in? Does it enter through the window or does it barge through the door? And so it, like, talks about how you feel feelings that, like, throughout your body. And sometimes they come quickly and sometimes they come slow, but we need to, like, it's important to let ourselves actually feel them. And so we use it as a, like, talking point. We'll read the book and we'll talk about our feelings, about specific feelings and where we feel them in our bodies. And so, like, I love that you created a book that allows you to, like, just talk with kids and open a discussion about things, like, because kids love books. I haven't met a single kid who doesn't like books. And so, oh, I just think that's beautiful. I love that you did that. And right. That it just kind of came about.
And they memorize the words. I mean, that's the coolest thing about using tetrabic pentameter, which is what Dr. Seuss used to create his poetry, is that even our 5-year-old granddaughter, who still speaks in 1 and 2 words, she understands everything about that book. And the interesting thing about kids with Down syndrome is that they are very smart, but they only focus on the key points. Mm-hmm. So it began on a Monday. She heard Hudson sneeze. That's the first line of Juliet and the Mystery Bug. Guess which word she remembers? Sneeze. And she picks out the key word in every stanza that is the most important word there. And it's almost like a super Reader's Digest condensation. Condensation. Yes.
I think so.
Stripping.
Condensing.
Condensing. There we go.
I was like, it's right there.
In your moment. Yes. This is what 6 concussions will do to you. You lose your words every now and then. But yeah, the condensation, you know, when they shrink it down, they get it to the absolute essence. And she is able to communicate perfectly for, like, our favorite thing that we do together is we dance. And her favorite song is Save the Last Dance for Me by Michael Bublé. And we have, she speaks not only with words, but also we taught her sign language. So she will touch her nose and say, me, Bublé. And she knows about the Amazon Echo. So she'll yell Alexa's name and say, Alexa Bublé. Of course, Alexa doesn't understand that. Yeah. But I do. And, in her little world of shorthand, she's able to communicate a lot in a very short time. And the magic moment for me with Mystery Bug was that, you know, we were trying to teach her about the proper way to wash your hands. Because, of course, the book is written based upon CDC protocols.
Yeah.
And I got a video one day from her mama. My son and his wife sent me a video, and it was Juliet, and she was in the bathroom, washing her hands exactly as I had taught her in the story. And the book hadn't been published yet. I was just showing her, like, pictures and trying out words on her. So when the book came, Hudson, who was her older brother, read it to her. And when she opened it to the page where the pictures of the hand washing were, she started making the movements. And I knew then that this was going to work. That this was something that was going to be really magic. And I hope it is. I hope it's something. The interesting thing for me about writing is I've never looked at writing as a way to make a living or as something that is at all selfish. I look at what writing can be as a tool for a bigger purpose. So when I wrote Chasing Vega, which is the story of Jessica Ramirez, my fantastic, badass little Latina detective, it really was about trying to create this diverse cast. Her partner's LGBTQ. The guy who is the medical examiner is on the autism spectrum. I have just this rainbow of people in there. And I wanted to create a cast so that people would naturally think as they read it, wow, maybe I can do this. Because for so many generations, we have marginalized people that don't look like us, don't think like us, don't come with the same mental toolbox that we have. And there's no reason that anybody on this earth can't dream big dreams and do big things. So my goal with Chasing Vega was to create this cast and then to go out in the community with the woman on whom Vega is based, who is an authentic 25-year cop and had all the challenges that a female cop does. And my goal was to, we were going to go to towns where there were organized Latino communities and there were organized female police officer groups and try to convince more young girls to think about law enforcement. So this is before the pandemic. And my goal was we picked out these eight cities. I was going to go get on the stage and I'm going to say, hey, I'm Terry Shepard. This is the book. And I have a movie trailer I made for it. And then I said, and here's Tracy. She is the one on whom a Jessica is based. Take it away, Trace. And then just let Tracy tell stories for the next hour. And then I'd have my wife, Colleen, sit out in the exit area with a box of books. And anybody that want to buy one would buy one. But the goal was, I think this is the way that I think the world works. And maybe I'd be very interested in your point of view on this too, Kayleen. But I think that we are put here on this earth to figure out what purpose is. And passion follows purpose and money follows passion. So if you can figure out why you're here, and I think that why I'm here is to make a difference in other people's lives, and then figure out a way you can do that within your passion. And for me, there's no better feeling in the world than to see somebody achieve their potential who didn't think they could. And I've seen that happen so many times in my life and have had the honor of playing a small role in some of those transformations, that that's what I try and do in everything that happens, everything that I do. So when I started writing, that was the goal. And it makes writing a lot more fun because when the characters get inside your head and start talking to you, they're asking questions like, well, why can't I do that? And, you know, teach me how to do this. And so, of course, you got to figure out how to get them so that they can do that.
Oh, my gosh. I love it. I love it so much. Seriously, I love this so much. And I think you're absolutely right. Like this, even this podcast, like I didn't expect for it to happen. Like, this isn't where I was going. Like, I had no intentions of like ever starting a podcast. That was never on my radar, but it just kind of happened as I followed what I wanted, as I followed my passion. It just kind of came here and it is my passion. I love it so much. You like, despite all the naysayers, like I love it because it's doing something beautiful. And I've had so many people reach out and thank me for specific episodes because it really touched them. And I love that that's what you get with writing. And I love that you're making it more than just writing. You're like, it's more than just writing. And it's more than just podcasting. Like, it's about connection.
Yeah.
And helping people.
And the fascinating thing that I've discovered in my journey as a writer of fiction, because I wrote many books in the nonfiction realm, is that it's about the characters. One of my good friends is an executive at Disney. And I asked him, I said, why did you buy, Marvel? And why did you buy Lucasfilm? And he said, we didn't buy them for the movies. We bought them for the characters. And so as I think about Jessica and Allie, my two stars who do all this stuff, I'm thinking about what are the stages that I can put them on. So naturally, I had Vega translated into Spanish. I found a really, really great Spanish storyteller. And I said, just use the plot points and make it your own. And if you need to change something so it fits better for the audience, it's all yours. And she wrote this beautiful version of Chasing Vega in Spanish. And of course, when it came time for the audiobook, I found this amazing Broadway actress narrator named Cynthia Farrell, who is half of her background is Hispanic, and she can speak both languages perfectly and understands the cultural connection. So there was that chemistry there. As I was talking with her, I'm a chemistry guy. I like working with people that I feel I got chemistry with. And I'm feeling that with you, Kayleen. This is your response. We got it. We got it.
Yes.
But as I didn't have to give Cynthia any direction. She knew exactly what to do. So that was out there. And then I started playing with, I have one of the things I'm working on now is a graphic novel version, because that's a different group, right? It's a whole different audience.
It's a whole different medium.
Yeah. So I want to put Jessica and Allie on as many stages as possible so that they can tell their story to that audience that likes that venue in their own way and see where it goes.
Oh, beautiful, 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 beautiful. I want to hear your story. So Let's go to the physical scar. We always start with the physical scar because it's typically a little bit easier to kind of get into the vulnerability and whatnot, starting with the physical scar. I don't feel like you have any issues with vulnerability. Like, that's kind of what I'm picking up from you is I feel like you're good. But let's start with the physical scar. What physical scar are you going to talk to us about?
Yeah, that was a hard one because I've got three. You know, I got the little scar on the chin that every boy gets. I'm sure my husband has two.
Two
and a girl, right? And the girl. And you know, when our son got his, we took him into the ER and the doc goes, I see them all, you know, look at every man, they've got it. So that was my first one. And then I ran into a bicycle axle and I got a scar on my leg from that. But I think probably the ones that may have affected me the most are that I was very prone to concussions. I was just, and this struck me, you know, as I was thinking about us being together, I was watching the Hemingway biography on PBS, and that poor guy, I mean, in addition to his mental illness challenges, I mean, he got hit in the head a lot and really hard. And I've had six between hockey and football and life, you know, baseball. I was a baseball pitcher, got beamed. You know, I've been sent back, you know, into the past many a time, like a broken record. And I think that probably has had something to do with my mental capacities in some way, shape or form. I never felt it. I mean, that's that's the outer scar, the inner scar that we discovered many years ago was that our family has the depression gene. And the way that they used to describe it, you know, when you look on ancestry.com and you talk to your parents and grandparents about so-and-so three or four generations back and tell me about them, they would be talking about this thing called melancholy. Yeah. And Abraham Lincoln had clinical depression. He was prone to melancholy. I never realized that that's what it was, because a lot of depressed people are the happiest ones in the room. You just can't tell. And it wasn't until I was working in New Mexico that my primary care physician was listening to me talk about my empathy for some people that I was working with, that I was helping, that were struggling. And she said, you got depression. You know that, don't you? And I laughed. Are you kidding me? No, I'm the one who pulls everybody out. And she says, do me a favor, will you? She says, if you'll promise me that you'll try this medication for 30 days and not get off it, because it takes time to get to do its work. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Then let's talk and you tell me what you think. And that started to take me in the right direction. That was about maybe 12 years ago now. And along the way, I've been in and out of medication. We live in Florida now, but when we came down here, it was the first time that I wasn't in a corporate gig where I was responsible for hundreds, like 600-700 employees and tens of thousands of customers and, you know, close to $1 billion in annual revenue. And so I was at this loose end thing. And all of a sudden I felt like I didn't have value anymore as a human being because I couldn't do what I thought my purpose was. And as I talked to my psychiatrist, she said, the question that you always ask everybody eventually is, what would you do if you were working for love and not for money? What if that was your thing? And I didn't know. I had no idea. You know how that works. We can give advice, but we can't take it. So she said, there's your assignment. And Colleen and I decided that we would try the writing thing, that I would try the writing thing for a year. Because, you know, my shrink and my financial people were telling me, you don't need to go out. My whole thing had been about taking care of my family and making money, putting points on the board financially. And I was at a point in my life where that didn't have to happen. It's such a big, you know, investment anymore of my time and life. And I did a lot of things I really didn't enjoy so that I could make sure that my family could have a great life. So to finally think about what it was that would make me happy was really weird because I'd never done that before. And I just kind of picked writing fiction out of the air. And I'm guessing, you know, you said this at the beginning of the show, that eventually every author writes the story of their own pain. I mean, those of us that get into fiction do that. And I haven't really done that yet, I don't think. As I'm watching Jessica's third story come together, there are dimensions in there where I'm allowing myself to go into those dark corners. But as I talk to other authors, they've all done it. They have all done it. And they'll pick out the book and they'll say, that one is the one. So it's a very, I think, healthy, therapeutic way to look at what it is that troubles you from a distance. And that's ultimately what we have to do. If we're doing it well, we have to be able to kind of leave this body that we've been given and float above it. My friends who are into paranormal talk about these near-death experiences where they're over the operating table kind of watching themselves and trying to decide whether they're going to stay or go. I never have had that experience, but that's what I try to do. I try to step outside of the self that I've created all these years to see if that's the self that still needs to be, or if I need to be somebody else. And that's a fascinating bit of research, and it generates some very interesting discussion inside your head.
Yes. I really love this, like stepping back and looking at yourself, because it's so funny. I was like, the episode that's going up today that just went up today. We actually kind of talk about that, is how you have to like reflect on yourself. You have to be able to look outside of yourself within yourself. Like I'm having a hard time explaining it, but you have to be able to look at you from an outsider's perspective and kind of examine things.
It takes courage. And not everybody does. Can do it.
It can be really painful. It can be so painful to do that, but it's so good. It's so funny that we're bringing this up, because seriously, like one of the exact things I said in the podcast that's going up today, and I think it's worth repeating, is so much of the time we don't want to think of ourselves as the bad guy. I'm putting air quotes. We don't want to think of ourselves as the bad guy when we do something. But sometimes we are wrong. Sometimes we kind of are the bad guy, but we don't see that unless we look at ourselves outside of ourselves. And when we can be like, oh, maybe I need to change this. That's really hard. And that's really painful. And it doesn't even have to be that. Like it could be like nothing like that. It's just looking from the outside in, you realize that, oh, there's some things that I have not dealt with. There's some pain there that I need to work through. And that hurts and it's hard. And you're right. It takes so much courage to be able to do that. But I think it's so important to get to the point where we can do that, because I think that's where our love and our passion and our connect, that's where everything can be released when we actually work on ourselves from that core.
Yep. Well, my situation is the exact opposite, because I always think I'm the bad guy. I take responsibility for everything. The pandemic, world hunger, the lack of peace in the world, that's my fault. I'm not doing enough to make a difference in that space. And that's, you know, when I first discovered what was behind that, it's what we all have. And that's the unworthiness gene. I mean, everybody has it. It stands in the way. It's what Seth Godin calls resistance. It's the thing that's whispering in your ear saying, nah, you can't do that. You could never do that. You know, you could never do it. Kaylin, you could never do a podcast. I mean, I'm sure that was whispering in your ear. And when you get a naysayer that says, wow, that wasn't what I expected, was a nice thing, or it sucks, you know, like a 1-star rating for an author. It just confirms what you already knew all along. And that is that you're not worthy. When in reality, it's the exact opposite. I mean, we don't come with manuals. Our kids don't. You know, I told our children when they were young, I said, look, your mom and I have no idea what we're doing. We're just rolling the dice on this. But we love you. We're coming at you from a place of love. So now, before you're 18, when you become an adult, you get to make your own decisions. Before you're 18, I'm going to make them for you, because I want you to live to be 18, right?
Yes.
So before they were grownups, they were always angry with us, because I would say, well, when you're an adult, you get to make your own decision. And now that they're in their 40s, they come to me and they say, Dad, what should I do? And I say, you're an adult. You get to make your own decisions. So there's a damn it in there either way. No matter how old you are, they're always angry about that. But I think that's, you know, we have to stop beating ourselves up for things like that. We have to be able to, the hardest thing in the world is self-forgiveness, because we want to be strong and look and say, okay, this is where I screwed up. This is where I could have been better. You know, this is where I could have done something. And a lot of times, one of the things I've learned is that good intentions don't always lead to good outcomes. And it doesn't matter what your intentions are, even if they are good and there's bad outcomes that are happen as a result of your behaviors, you have to learn how to own that. Even if you're innocent. I mean, we've been brought up by watching situation comedies and hearing marketers tell us that if we're good, then, you know, karma will take care of the bad people and stuff. And that's not the way it works in the world. And that's part of what makes a really good thriller is you take a good person who has some flaws and you run them up a tree and start throwing hand grenades at them. And then they got to figure out what to do to get down and not only defeat whoever those demons are, internal or external, but how to do it in a way that inspires the reader to want to read the next book. That's the challenge of being an author.
Oh, and it's so beautiful. And oh my gosh, like I think everyone can connect with not feeling like they're enough or the whole imposter syndrome. Like everyone can connect with that. And I think it's another one of those things where if you can look at it from without your, like outside of yourself, because this is something that I've tried to do because I get stuck in being really hard on myself sometimes. And so much of the time I'll be like, or, and my husband will help remind me because he's very good about that. He's like, would you say this to someone else if they were telling you about their experience?
Oh, what a gift of love.
And I was like, no, of course I would never say, like, no, I would never say this to someone else. So why am I saying it to myself? And it's just an interesting way to kind of help me be like, okay, I shouldn't be talking to myself or thinking about myself this way because I would never talk or think about this way, about this to someone else. Like I would never think this way or say this to someone else. So why am I doing it to myself?
And I just think about how many women are out there are saying, man, I wish I had a husband like yours. That's not what they're hearing. A lot of times our loved ones quietly, it's called microaggression. They quietly reinforce that unworthiness gene, a lot of times even without meaning to do it. And once you build your radar for those kind of things, for listening for them. And that's another interesting thing about this, the whole author of fiction stuff is that we authors have this really, really bad habit of getting real quiet in restaurants because we're zeroing in on the conversation at the table next to us for dialogue. We need dialogue. And it sometimes will drive my wife nuts because I'll be listening, pretending like I'm listening to her and nodding to what she's saying. And then she'll like stop and ask me a question and I'm still nodding. She'll say, you're listening to those guys at the table next to us, aren't you? And I go, yeah, do you know what they're saying? It's really interesting. It's fantastic. The one on the left, he needs to be in therapy. You know, he really does. And she says, I was talking about something else and I need your full attention.
Oh my gosh.
That never happens in your marriage, does it?
No. So what happens with us is we actually both listen into the conversation. We love eavesdropping, not to be like, oh, I want to know. Like, it's really more just, I want to hear this. Like, for a whole like dialogue thing. And like, I don't know. We both love like listening to other people's conversations. I have a degree in theater. He technically does have a degree in theater as well, but he did more of the film aspect and he's like a video editor. And so we're both very drawn to dialogue and the way people speak and what they talk about. Yep. So we would both be listening in a conversation.
And your husband is always thinking about, okay, where would I cut? Okay, we don't need that little dialogue. We're pulling that out. That's what I'm sure you do. I don't know if you edit. I mean, I do post-production in my podcast because I want to make my guests sound good. So I'm like always listening to my questions and saying, man, I rambled too long there. I'm cutting. I'm guessing that's probably what's going on in your husband's head when you're out at the restaurant. Is he saying, nah, we didn't need that part. That's boring. We're taking that out. Yes. How are we moving the story forward here, guys? And don't you wish? I mean, it's like watching I think it's Annie Hall, right? Where they're at in the line at the theater and he's listening to the guy behind him say this stupid stuff. And then all of a sudden he breaks the fourth wall and he says, this is nuts. This guy's crazy. I don't know how people are like that. And the guy says to the audience, he says, I'm entitled to my opinion. I know I teach a class about Marshall McLuhan. And Woody brings Marshall McLuhan out and says, well, I just happen to have Mr. McLuhan here. And tell him. And Marshall McLuhan says, you don't know what you're talking about. How you were able to teach any class is amazing. And you wish life would be like that sometimes.
Yes. Yes. Yes, I do. Oh, I love it. Oh, this makes me so happy. So I would really like to hear more about your like internal scars, because I like reread your the email that I the form that you filled out. And I would love to hear more about like the internal scars. I mean, you've kind of been talking about them along, but I'd love for you to delve in a little bit more.
Yeah. I mean, the hardest thing for me is that for most of my life, I have been, I come from a family of teachers and preachers, and I was the odd one because I was the business guy. And, but part of the secret, I think, of my success in business is I tried to treat both my customers and my team members as my flock, right? So I was very interested in what was going on with them, because, you know, a lot of times when there are performance issues, it has nothing to do with the job or the process. It's something that's going on outside. So that was my thing. And in a lot of instances over many years, I've been doing that stuff for five decades, I would find these people that were miscast, right? So we would talk, and I'd ask the question, what would you do if you're working for love and not for money? And a lot of people changed as a result of that, because they would, for the first time, come to grips with a marriage that wasn't working for them. Or in one case, I had a woman that was a fantastic marketer, but needed to be on the stage. She needed to be an actress. And she is. She's been on Longmire. She's been on half, you know, dozens of, she's a character actress and has created that herself, you know, out of a dream. And that's what I really like to do. And I really can't do that anymore. You know, I'm not in a situation where I can do that every day for people. So my world is compressed to my children and my grandchildren and the inner circle of, you know, in our lives, we have many acquaintances, but maybe only four or five people that we would call close friends who we'd walk in front of a bus for. And that's a real small, you know, when your life has been one where you're constantly looking for ways to help people be better and achieve their potential, to not be able to do that is really painful. And that happened to me when we ended up coming down here. Right before that happened, my father died. And you know, the reason we were staying where we were living is because he was in this fantastic assisted living facility. We called it a cruise ship on land. He had wonderful people surrounding him, and he was sharp until the end. But that was one thing. And then a year ago, February, my sister committed suicide. And the backstory behind that is she's the one that actually alerted us to the fact that the gene was active in our family, because when she was in college, she struggled. She was in the dean's list the first semester, and then she got a B, and that triggered her depression. And she couldn't even get up to go to class because it was horrible. And she was thinking, why should I even live if I can't get all A's? Well, she fought through that and was able to be very healthy for a long time, to the point that her husband had no idea. I mean, he knew because she'd talked with him about it, but he had no idea how that manifests. Well, the thing that, just to make it the story short, the thing that triggered her was she got a blood clot, and it did some things that did some damage to her internal organs, and there was a question about quality of life, and she didn't want to be a burden. And the one of the drugs that they gave her to try and help her actually did some very serious damage to her liver. And so she was looking at the prospect of being unable to work, unable to feed herself, unable to do anything without assistance. She was afraid that it was going to drain their finances, even though it wasn't. And she did the balance sheet, and she decided that the best decision for her, since she couldn't have her what she wanted in the way of life, was to end it. And so that's what she did. She made that choice and walked in front of a train. And that was tough. I mean, I knew how bad she was, because I'd been there to see her, and her husband was just beside himself. He didn't know what to do. But I'd been through it before with her before. And just from what I, my own experience with depression, I was telling them, look, these are ultimately the individual's going to make the decision about what they want to do. And there comes a point for all of us. I mean, having witnessed that with my own parents, as they could, you know, I like to say, got rid of bodies that could no longer contain their spirit, right? Now, there comes a point in your life where the value just isn't there for you anymore. And for most people, because of our society, we try and prolong life after the quality's gone. And my grandmother was like one of the early advocates for that because she had Parkinson's disease and was just in horrible shape. And she says, I'm ready to get out of here. You know, I'm ready to go. But she was too healthy everywhere else. And in my sister's case, I think she made that's a decision she made. She didn't even note or anything, but she was helping me edit Vega at the time. And we talked a lot about it. So when I heard that, I was stunned, shocked, sad, grief stricken. But I also had respect for her because, you know, she was thinking this was a gift for her of love to her family. And her husband says, 20 years too early. I was not ready for that, but she was. And I think in her case, she made that decision. The tragic thing for me is how people, especially people that are depressed, can feel like they're at that place when they aren't. And I've felt that many times, but now that I've been through a lot of therapy and I've got the right, my brain chemistry is balanced properly now, I have the right medication, I know when I'm headed to the dark, you know, it's a sine wave. It's like this roller coaster we live. There are good days and there are bad days. And I know when I'm heading into that bad day, but I also know that I'll come out of it. Yeah. And depressed people who become suicidal can't see that light at the end of the tunnel. And all they want is relief. They want it to be over. They want their suffering to end. And I got a very interesting conversation with the medical examiners before I was writing fiction and talking to, you know, docs that did not touch these all the time. And I was saying to him, how could you be in such a good mood? You're like, you see these horrible, horrible things and you got to take them apart, you know? And he looked at me and he says, look, when I get them, their suffering's over. Their spirit is gone. All I've got's the Hulk and it's the science. And I'm fascinated by the science. And I'd never thought of it that way.
That is crazy.
I mean, isn't that fascinating? I mean, it changed my whole outlook on that job. I didn't think I could ever do that job.
Yeah.
It's interesting because it's a real pain in the neck in a lot of dimensions of his life. But as far as his attitude towards his work, he was this happy guy. I mean, he certainly had the empathy for those of us that were processing the grief associated with the loss. Because it's the people who are left behind that really do the suffering. And especially if they don't understand what's going on, or if somebody has made a bad decision. And that happens a lot of times where this stuff is concerned as they decide too soon. And that's hard. It takes time to get through that. But I miss my sister every day, especially as I'm writing, because I wish I had her editorial prowess. And she's also a book promoter. So she was giving me all these great ideas on how to get the book promoted. But I do hear her whispers. And I think that this is the way, even with our best friends that are still around, is that our thing, as things are happening in our lives, it's the, you know, what would Kayleen do? I really admire her. She's somebody that's made a difference in my life. How would she handle this? And if you're not sure, we have the luxury of being able to call you and talk to you about it. And sometimes even your own insecurity about being able to give a good answer, because one of the things we're afraid of as people is we're going to give bad advice.
Yeah.
That is a teaching tool as well. Because sometimes not knowing what is right, the right way to go, is the way it's got to be. As M. Scott Peck said in The Road Less Traveled, if you suffer fully, you will make the right decision, but you will not know it at the time.
Oh, I love all of this so much. So, you may not have even knowingly done this, but I am extremely passionate about like mental health and suicide awareness and stuff like that. When I was 18, my best friend committed suicide. And I've known multiple people since then who have taken their own lives. And I'm now QPR certified, question persuade refer. So I'm QPR certified. Because I think it's really important to be able to kind of notice the signs. Oh, this person's not going down a good path. Like mm-hmm. they're going on a pretty negative path right here. And the thing that always gets me about it is they don't think that there's any other way out.
Yeah.
Typically when people are to the point of suicide, they think that it's the best option. And they can't see, they can't see anything else around it. It's the only option. It becomes the only correct option for them. And that's hard because suicide is completely preventable, but it still stands. How do you help get them out of that? And sometimes, especially if you don't get it soon enough, sometimes you just can't because they make their decision. And you can't make their decision for them.
Yeah. And all you can really do, I mean, the best thing you can do is just to be the witness, be a witness and be a listener. And
yeah.
My last corporate iteration, I found all the people in my shop who were depressed. And we made a little kind of club. It wasn't an official club, but we all knew each other's medications and we would laugh about the side effects. And, you know, there'd be these little texts that would come and say, I'm having a Xanax day or something like that. And then like when Robin Williams committed suicide, we were all floating around each other's offices just to make sure that, you know, the other people were okay. And that support community, I think was really important, and you need to know that you're not alone. But this whole idea of there only being one, you know, this kind of blinders or just you're looking down this very narrow telescope for options it's a human frailty just in general. I think the people I admire most are the crazy nut jobs who see everything as an opportunity. Like, and I say nut job because I'm one of them. Like as the pandemic was coming and I was seeing businesses start to close and restaurants start to close up. And then I'm looking at, you know, Uber Eats and DoorDash. And all of a sudden, you know, our date nights, my wife and I have been, every Wednesday's date has been date night for us for all 44 years we've been together. I've missed maybe six in 44 years, and we couldn't go out anymore. So all of a sudden we're thinking, okay, so how can we make this magic within these temporary confines, right? So we started thinking about how much money we were saving because we weren't buying martinis. We were making them at home. So instead of spending $8 or $10 or $12, we were spending two, right? Because you buy your alcohol at Publix or the grocery store. So we're thinking, wow, this is cool. And now it's the point we can start going out again. And we went out to one of our favorite Italian restaurants and I go, holy cow, this thing is expensive, you know, because we've been getting takeout. You know, we've just been buying the outlets and stuff. So thinking about that, there's always, you know, whatever it is you're doing, like as I think about what you're doing, how could you put together a best of, or is there a book in this for you? You know, can you take the best ideas you've learned from these people that you've talked to, and what are the common themes? And is there a way that you could become a published author? At some point, your experience as a podcaster is going to become important enough that you'd make a great guest, right? but those are things a lot of us don't think about. We get in the zone. Yeah. We see one thing, and then there's distractions. I've got three kids. There's no way that I how am I going to find time to do that? I don't have time to do this, right? But that is the challenge. If you can turn the prism and see the different colors that are shown on the wall of your point of view, in those colors is an answer, is something different, is something newer. And that's the beginning of reinvention. And reinvention is essential to continuing to find joy in life.
Yes. On this note, something that I believe wholeheartedly is that every person's unique. And so everybody has a very unique thing that they can bring into those things that they create. There is something that you can create that no other person alive can create because they've never had the exact same experiences that you have. They've had similar experiences. People have had similar experiences. They've gone through similar things, but no one has had the experiences that you have had in your life. So you have something unique that no one else can give. And if you can tap into that and be like, what can I bring to the table here? Because there's something that you can bring that no one else can. And I think that when we can tap into that and just accept that about ourselves, just accept that, like, I have this immense amazingness within me that I can bring to the world. If you can just accept that and lean into it, like, beautiful things start to happen.
Well, and that's amazing, the fun part about being a storyteller is that part of your research, you know, if you pick a character, whatever that is, you need to dig into that person, especially if they're not like you. So one of my biggest fears about writing Vega was that I'm talking about cultures and experiences and people and ability levels that I know nothing about. And in the world today, it's very easy to be canceled because they're considering you're expropriating culture. And that I did not want to do that. And in fact, I wanted to do the opposite, which was I wanted to immerse myself in the experience that these other people had. And, you know, for me, one of the fun, the best parts about all this was talking to the guys, the men and women that I used as my examples for people on the autism spectrum, and learning the magic that's inside of those heads. There is one little filter that's kind of screwed up a little bit so that they struggle to be able to communicate in the way that we're used to. They aren't, you know, they can't take the script that you would put on stage and get into that character to deliver it in a way that the audience expects.
Yeah.
But when you drop that expectation and you just witness again, and you assume that they are people of value and find the love in your heart for what they have to offer, that magic just comes flowing out. The person that I get the most mail about in Chasing Vega is the medical examiner, Joey Price. And if you read the book, those are the scenes that you will feel connected to, because Joey just sits there. You know, they're yelling at him and saying, why haven't you done this? Why haven't you done that? Well, he has. He's thought about it. He's got it figured out. He just waits for you to be done. And like, there's one scene where he loses a key piece of evidence. They come in and somebody's broken into the morgue and they've stolen the key piece of evidence. It was in a Ziploc bag on the table and it's gone. And so the sheriff's like just reading him the riot act, and he just casually pulls out this Ziploc bag from behind and holds it up. And the sheriff goes, what is that? He goes, that's the original. He says, I wanted to know how it works. So I went down to the head shop and bought another one. And I put it in a Ziploc bag, left it on the table there. I took the original home with me because I don't trust the security here. But I mean, I'm saying it like you and I would say it. You have to translate some of that so the reader can understand. Yeah. But for the people that this is the greatest compliment I've had in the books, is that people said, you got it right. My LGBTQ friends, they're all saying, why are you telling my secrets? That's me. That's me. That girl is me. How do you know that? I mean, you don't know me that well, you know? And I'm just saying, I just gave her a personality based upon what I've heard you say to me when we've had three or four drinks in us, you know? But they all say, it's so true. It's exactly the way that I feel. It's exactly the way that I cope. And it's exactly the way that I prevail, right? And that's what you want when you're telling a story. So I think that's the opportunity in life too. Is the real value for me is not so much what I know about myself or even about my own experience. It's what can I learn about somebody else's experience? And that's at the root cause, I think, not to be political, which I am about to, but I think that is the challenge we've got in this country right now, is that too many of us are unwilling to walk in somebody else's shoes. And if we could ever do that, if we could ever learn to do that, then we could start to address the horrific things in our past, like slavery, like poverty, lack of education, you know, people that have been left out, because you want opportunity to be there for everybody, because you never know if that person that you're not letting in the door is the one that's going to save your wife from dying from cancer. Right. Yeah. And that's the way I look at it. And hopefully all we can do is people, you and me, Kayleen, is we have our own ability to influence. So when I drive through the drive-through at the Burger King, I want to make sure that whoever that person is that's working there for minimum wage feels like a goddess or a god. Because I'm going to find something cool to say about what they're doing right or how they're looking or something like that. I want them to walk away from that day saying, I had a customer that made me feel better about myself. And I think if we all took that attitude, what would the world be like? Holy moly. I mean, it would be just amazing. But it starts with one, and it starts with us.
A freaking men. Oh my gosh. Yes, 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 yes. Just yes. I have so many thoughts.
Aren't you having a blast? This is great. This is great. This is like we're at a coffee shop just hanging out.
Yes, this is so good. I love that. Like, it's part of the reason this podcast has kind of like gone where it has gone is I want people to hear other people's stories. I very firmly believe that when you actually get to know someone who's different from you, if you actually get to know them and the things that they've been through, that's when you start to realize, oh, that's where you look outside of yourself. It's where you start to think, oh, I was kind of wrong about them. But it's not until we actually do that. We can't get to that point unless we listen to people, unless we actually listen and not just listen to respond, but actually just listen to understand. That I think our world and our, especially right now, our country would be extremely different if every single person listened to understand and not respond.
And it doesn't mean you have to agree with them or put up with bad behavior. I mean, that's part of it. I mean, there are some people, what is it? What's the old saying? Accept what you can't change what you can. But then the third thing that people forget about is remove yourself from the unacceptable. And there are some people that are not meant to be in your life. And that's part of the tragedy, I think, of a lot of relationships is that people stay around when they shouldn't, or, you know, you've been friends for so long that you just kind of put up with that person, even though they're sucking the energy out of you and you're like, need a day to recover after you've been on the phone with them. It's okay to let those people go. We don't have that much time. We need to be investing the time where we've got a return. And part of that is making the determination of who you're going to be close to and how you can make a difference. And put your time there. It's like a stock. You got to find a stock that's got growth potential and invest in that. And then dump the ones that not your, that's the biggest, kind of the biggest learning for me is it is not my responsibility to solve every problem, but it is my responsibility to contribute in some way to the solution.
I love that. I love it. And something that I think is really important, I know we need to end, but I want to say this. Something that I think is really important is just because someone is family by blood does not mean they have to be in your life.
No kidding. Sounds like you're speaking from experience there, Kaylee. You had that experience?
Yeah, just a little bit. I know most of my family and most of my in-laws don't listen to this, so I'm fine saying this. My husband has no desire to have his dad in his life. None. Because his dad has a personality disorder that he never got help for. And so there was just some mental and emotional abuse growing up. And so my husband has no desire to have any relationship with his dad, but his parents are in the middle of a divorce and his dad now lives 15 minutes away from us and stopped by uninvited one night. And that was my husband didn't, he went to the bathroom. Like when his dad stopped by, he went to the bathroom and stayed in the bathroom the whole time. And I dealt with it. Then I ended up having a conversation. I went because like my husband was very, like, for lack of better words, like my husband was very triggered by it.
Yeah, sure. Yeah.
And I saw, I was like, okay, this cannot happen. Like this cannot happen again. This is not acceptable. Not towards my husband, just like, this is unacceptable. You cannot live in a state like live in this state of being triggered if your dad comes by or if he calls. I'm like, this can't happen. And so I ended up having a conversation with my father-in-law and my husband's grandparents, because my father-in-law lives with his parents at this point. And so I went over and I took the kids over and I had a conversation. I was like, look, he doesn't want you in his life. So you are not to contact him. You're not to text him. You're not to call him. You're not allowed in our apartment. I will be the one to bring over the kids so that way they can still see you. But you do not contact him. You contact me and deal with me. And it actually went really well. Like, there was obviously some, like, a little bit of pushback, but overall it went really well. And he has not reached out since. But it's important, and it's been better because now my husband doesn't have to worry about it. He doesn't have to worry about those random texts or calls that come through. Yeah. Like, he doesn't have to worry about any of that. He never has to worry about going over because I put that boundary there. I'm like, he's not going to see you. And so that is all gone for him. And it has made things so much better. And that's for him. It's not even for me. Like, I'm still going to take the kids over occasionally so they can see their, you know, their grandpa and their great grandparents. And because I'm fine doing that, like, I would have said, I wouldn't have done it if I wasn't okay doing it.
So how did you get there? How did you get to that point where you have the shields, the Star Trek shields to protect yourself?
So for me, it took a long time to just be confident and know that I don't have to put myself down to make other people comfortable or happy. I don't have to put myself at risk to make someone else happy, to appease someone else. I'm important and I matter. And I can do what's comfortable for me, even if it makes someone else upset. And so I don't mind speaking up. So, and I have some mama bear in me. I'm sure you can see I have some red hair. It's kind of blending in with the brown background, but I am a redhead. And so I don't mind telling my father-in-law that he needs to stop. I don't mind speaking up, especially for my kids, and being like, you stop that. And so I can do it. I don't mind going over there because I know that, like, I can speak up and it's fine. And if it's especially on behalf of my kids, I'm going to have no issue speaking up and saying, no, that's not okay. You need to stop. And so,
bravo.
I don't know. It's taken a long time to get there. It's taken a very, very long time to get there. But I do think that is so important. Is like you said, like, some people don't need to be in your life.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's just the way it is.
In the end, family is a creation that we do. We make that happen. Yes. We get to choose who the people are that are going to be close to us. Yes. And, you know, part of that's your soulmate. So, you know, when you decided you were going to commit to your husband, that brought some other people into the realm, but that doesn't necessarily mean they have to be in your life. You can also, some of the most rewarding relationships you'll ever have will be people that you never knew existed until they came into your life.
Yep.
And treasure that. I mean, it's all about, I used to call it chasing happiness, but I think it's about chasing purpose. And if you can do that, then life works. It can work. That gets you through the bad days. Purpose does.
Yes. Oh, okay. We need to end. But I like this. That's why I said, I'm like, we're going to shoot to record for 45 minutes because I could talk for hours. But...
Thank you so much. This has been great.
Thank you.
Let me talk about my book. Thanks for asking me the tough questions. It's been just a super treat to be with you.
Thanks for listening. Stay tuned for a preview from next week. Just a reminder that you can get a copy of Empress Journal on Amazon for only $15. It helps me keep the show going and it helps you too. Links for Terry Shepherd and everything are in the show notes at scarswishare.com/podcast/episode084.
I now am in a hotel room with I would say Mexican gang affiliation, and I have a gun pointed in my face asking me what I know about this situation.